Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of the Proper Class Podcast. I'm Laura Checkley.
And I'm Hannah Chiswick.
And we are, of course, here to celebrate all things working class, because if we don't, ho, the bloody hell will. She's back, baby!
Oh, dear. I see that's been resurrected. That didn't last very long, did it?
No, well, I just got over my sweet self. I think it might be the heat, you know, knocking the ego out of me. It's all right. You don't like it. Michelle don't like it, but I do. So we're carrying on with that.
Great. Something lucky for you there, listener. So without further ado, who are we celebrating this week, Law?
Do you know what? Me and Han are once again having a bit of a pinch me moment, because we have been the biggest fans of this week's guests for many years now. Let me tell you, he does it all. He's a spoken word artist, a record producer, an actor, podcaster, and a British hip-hop legend. He spent his teenage years performing in bands with his mates and working at HMV. After writing his first full-hour set of spoken word and having saved up enough money to survive for a year, he quit his job, jumped in his 1987 Toyota Space Cruiser and hit the road seeking out big gigs, where he would perform outside of them to queuing crowds.
After a few months on the road, he headed back home and began performing again at open mic nights in Essex and London before teaming up with his ex-HMV colleague Dan Lesac, performing the duo Dan Lesac versus Scroobius Pip. They released the single Thou Shalt Always Kill, which was and still is an absolute fucking banger. Between them, they raised £200 to film the video. They went on to release their critically acclaimed debut album, Angles, which became one of the leading independent releases of 2008.
The duo toured the UK, Europe and the USA and played at many of the world's biggest music festivals. Despite being offered numerous deals with big labels, they decided to sign with independent label Sunday Best Recordings, and they went on to record 3 albums. In 2006, our guest's debut album, Commercial Breaks, was released through his own record label, Speech Development Records. At the time, there were only 1,000 copies of the album made, and obviously they sold out. So in 2012, the album was re-released as a double CD edition, following on from the 2011 release of his second solo album, Distraction Pieces.
And as always, being ahead of the curve, in 2013, he started his own podcast, the Distraction Pieces podcast, which has grown into a hugely successful iTunes chart-topping podcast.
Right, Christ, we better get our shit together then.
Right. Our guest has released 2 books, Distraction Pieces, a book to accompany his podcast, and previously, Poetry in Emotion, a series of his poetry illustrated by various contributors from around the world, who answered his MySpace call out to submit designs to accompany his poetry.
Not content with smashing it in virtually every artistic medium, in April 2013, XFM announced our guest was joining the station to host his own weekly show, The Beatdown, a full circle moment, as XFM was the station that had launched his record career. And in 2014, The Beatdown won Best Specialist Music Programme at the 32nd Annual Sony Radio Academy Awards. Put my teeth back in.
Breathe.
And breathe. Taking a pause from releasing new music, our guest has now turned his hand to acting. Hooray! Appearing in shows such as American series The Bastard Executioner, BBC drama Taboo, British comedy film Walk Like a Panther, and has even made it into the world of Marvel in Venom Let There Be Carnage.
I mean, what on earth is this guy going to do next? In all seriousness, Laura and I have been huge fans of this guest from the moment we first heard him, and we were first in line to get tickets for his sellout Edinburgh Festival Festival show back in 2013. So it really is a total pleasure to give a huge Proper Class podcast welcome to the multifaceted, multi-talented, total legend that is Scroobius.
Scroobius!
Hello, guys. God, that was lovely. I've done loads of stuff, haven't I? I forget how many different jobs I've had over the years.
How do you feel hearing it all back?
It's funny because it makes me think. I was talking to a mate of mine recently who started working near a particular dock in London, and I was like, oh, I used to unload cruise liners there, and the amount of jobs I've had before all of this nonsense is just as ridiculous, from Pizza Hut to HMV to delivering big bags of flour in the
which
in the
I'm
mornings.
So interested in talking about all
of these
that.
Different things. So.
I said to Hannah earlier, I said, my God, he's had like so many lives. It seems.
I just kept busy, I guess. But yeah, it's lovely. It is lovely to hear all those kind of things. I'm always uncomfortable with compliments for some reason, but you guys will know, anything in the arts or self-employed even, you've got to be constantly moving and constantly on the go, and you don't often get a chance to look back and go, oh, I've done some good stuff, actually. That's quite nice. And I really obsess over whatever I'm doing at the moment. So acting and script writing is all I'm thinking about. And every now and then I'll get reminded of this music career or these other things and be like, oh, yeah, oh, that was me, wasn't it?
I was working with some young actors last week, and I was saying to them, like, of course, you've always got to like have your eye on what you might like to do next, and it's great to be creatively ambitious, but it's good to take a pause and remind yourself, like, what 15-year-old you would have thought, like, bloody hell.
Yeah.
You know, we've all got ambitions and things that we'd like to do, but it's amazing to think back on, like, yeah, what younger you would have made of all the stuff you've done.
I was chatting to David Earl recently, who's a comedian and actor that I'm a big fan of, and he's a pal, and he was asking if I get nervous on set, because he gets really nervous before every acting gig. And I kind of don't. And he was saying he gets nervous because of imposter syndrome, and he worries he doesn't belong there. And I realised I'm about three careers on from knowing I definitely don't belong there. Like, all of this is a bonus. Like, as the music career, that shouldn't have... I was the kid with a stammer in a small town in Essex. It's like, music should never have been, particularly spoken word, should never have been mine. So everything after that, I think I don't get particularly nervous, because I'm just excited going, how mad is this? Like, I'm allowed on set and things like this. So there's no imposter syndrome. I know I'm an imposter. There's no doubt over that. I don't panic on that. Yeah. It's like, no, that's a given. Let's just enjoy it now. So, yeah.
We normally start every week by just asking our guests to take us back to a place or a time that really reminds them of their working class roots. So if you were going to take us somewhere, where would you take us?
Well, it was weird on this because with preparation and stuff like that, and again, I'm sure we'll go into this on the acting, I over prep on stuff sometimes because of having a stammer, because I know I need to really do my work to know where I'm going to breathe, where I'm going to do all this. But on this, I kept thinking about it, and the first thing that came to mind was the one I had to deck with, and it's not Essex based. All my family from South London. So from the age of 4 or 5, pretty much every weekend, we'd go to Millwall, and we'd be on the terraces at Millwall every week. We'd go to the same caff in Greenwich every week, run by a bloke called Peter. We'd be excited because often Danny Baker would be in there, like having his pre-match fry up as well. And then we'd go and get our South Stand upper seats. We'd get there 30 to 60 minutes early so we could get a good seat. Or early days, it'd be in the family enclosure. And again, it's mad because Millwall has got such a bad reputation, and often well-deserved. You know, I think it benefited me to see racism, violence, all sorts of thing at an early age, and people fighting against it. But like at Millwall in the family enclosure in them days, there'd be half-time entertainment for the kids. So there'd be a clown coming out, or literally a Punch and Judy show.
That'd be the last football. Yeah. That'd be like the last football ground, I think, that would be that would be happening.
There'd be like Amdram, or there'd be like Punch and Judy or whatever else in this little area to entertain the youngsters at half-time. So, yeah, things like that always the deck with me. We'd always get our sweets before the game because they're going to be more expensive in the ground.
Yeah.
And things like that. All those basic things of just being there as a family at first, like me, my mum, dad, and my brother would go, and sometimes our mate Rick, my uncles would go, and my cousins would go. And then as the years went on, it went down to just me and my dad more often than not. But yeah, it feels like it's been a key place and memory of being around proper working class people, being comfortable around working class people who are getting passionate.
Yeah.
Because again, at football, you get all of the emotions. You get people who are proper angry. You get people who are proper sad. You get to witness all of these real extreme emotions in at a game, you know, within 90 minutes. I've got so many of my favourite memories are at Millwall, of being a kid there, of being a grown up there. And again, that place where you learnt that it's okay to show emotion. You know, yeah, I think people underrate how important that is, particularly for working class men.
Yeah,
100%. To be somewhere where they can genuinely hug each other and kiss each other and get excited and get angry and have this whole wave of emotions in 90 minutes and then go home. You know, it's such a weird, it's a therapy in a way. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's incredible, isn't it? It's probably the only time I really, really see my stepdad and my brother go from one extreme to the other. We're a Liverpool supporters.
Yeah.
And we've obviously had an amazing few years. But yeah, seeing their emotions and them hugging each other, and they never hug each other. Yeah. You're right. It's I've never really thought about that. But as you learning as a young man, young boy, that emotions are all right.
Yeah.
That it's all right, you know?
Yeah.
Let's take you back then, seeing as we're going back. Talk to us about where you grew up, school. How was school for you?
So I grew up, I'm looking out my window now. My mum still lives about a 15-minute walk in that direction.
Oh, how lovely.
My dad lives about 10 minutes in that direction because they're separated. But yeah, I'm kind of in the middle of everything of my upbringing. So in this small town called Stamford Lee Hope, I went to Catholic schools because my parents thought that's going to be the better of the options.
Good school, yeah.
And so I went to, in my secondary school, I used to have to get the train to school because I went to an all-boys Catholic school in Southend. Could only go there because I passed my 11 plus, and that meant that they had to cover our travel.
Right.
We wouldn't have afforded to go to a school further away that was a slightly better school if travel wasn't covered. And it was years of getting on trains and music in headphones with mates and getting the train into school. It was an all right school. It wasn't an amazing school, but it was decent enough. But it was kind of, I feel I did most of my education and learning after I left school. That's when I kind of got more of a passion for things.
I take it you were fairly academic, because if you passed your 11 pluses, because I did my 11 pluses and I failed miserably.
I did all right. I scraped past, I think. My brother flew through them. I think I scraped through them. And yeah.
It's interesting, 11 pluses, isn't it? It's given so many people that wouldn't have had an opportunity to a better education.
Yeah.
Was school good for you? Did you enjoy it? How did you find it?
It's a weird one. It had its ups and downs. Again, I touched upon it earlier. I've had a stammer since I was four, so school is going to have its ups and downs in that situation. Now as kind of a grown-up, I understand that you're starting at a new school, and it's not that you go there wanting to bully someone or target someone, but you go there not wanting to be the one bullied. And if the first thing they do is call the register and there's one kid that can't answer it, it's like, there's the one. We're, you know, him.
Yeah,
But I'm quite tall and quite big. So again, even then, I don't think I had it that bad. I certainly don't feel I was the bottom of the ladder as such. It's the typical in-betweeners thing, isn't it? I was kind
right.
of, I wasn't the nerdiest of the nerds. I certainly wasn't one of the cool kids, but yeah, it was fine, really. I wasn't passionate about it. I don't have all these amazing memories, but also I didn't hate it. It's not the worst days of my life or anything. So yeah.
And did you get into, were you good at English? Were you into drama? Where does your love of language and words and music come from?
My English teacher took my mate, or one of my best mates, Mark Irvine, aside and said, you can do better than hanging out with Pip and Martin Birmingham, our other mate, because we were she saw us as naughty and not as clever as him. He was a lot cleverer. So yeah, I didn't do great English. I didn't get on with my English teacher. I think my vocabulary got good. My vocabulary got good. Sounds like didn't phrase that well at all.
I didn't think there was anything wrong with it. So there we go. You're in good company.
Exactly. I think I improved my vocabulary a lot because of my stammer. I think I'd always be thinking a sentence or two ahead of words I'm going to trip up over, right, and I'd be replacing them with other words. So I think I built a little kind of thesaurus in my mind, and my language, yeah, my vocabulary grew as a defence mechanism as much as anything, I think. And then, yeah, wow, it was only after school that I started to want to, like, I've never been a big reader. I've had to force myself to become more of a reader, because at school I wasn't a big reader. I was good at maths and I was good at art, and they weren't two things that particularly crossed over that were helpful to work together.
Yeah, you often find you're either good at one or the other, didn't you? Yeah.
What did you do when school came to an end?
I took a year out. I tried to travel around America. Oh, that's it. No, I did college, sorry. And then I went and took a year off, and tried to travel America. It didn't go well. I ran out of money quick. I was on my own. I thought I'd be able to get jobs and stuff, but I hadn't thought about the fact I was 18. But 18 in the UK, I can go in pubs and clubs and meet people. 18 in America, I couldn't go in any pubs or clubs or anything. So that didn't go well. Came back and went to uni doing photography for a year. And that was another one where I was a year in and I wasn't comfortable with the debt I was getting in.
Yeah. Really?
I couldn't balance it in my head. The whole thing that, you know, you don't have to pay it back unless you earn over a certain amount. But it's like, well, that essentially is saying either I'm not going to earn much or I'm going to work hard and do well and just be paying this back. And it spun me out. So after a year, I dropped out of uni and worked in everywhere, as I said, kind of retail, delivery, factories, all sorts. And it was working in HMV that I started to write silly raps on the back of till receipts with my mates, like just about different people, diss raps about different members of staff.
And had you done that before, or was it just, you know, you loved listening to music pre that?
It was working somewhere like HMV was a godsend for me, because particularly at that point, HMV was the one that all the music fans worked in. Virgin was more of just a shop. HMV
you always
was real...
knew that when you went in looking for something, you know, you just knew the staff at HMV knew
their shit. Give you their knowledge.
Yeah. They didn't want to know me because I like the Spice Girls, so they were like,
there you go. Get your CD. But that was it. I was working with more and more people who were as passionate about music as I was and films, but could teach me more and could expand my horizons. So, there was a little crew of us who were really into our hip-hop and really into our kind of underground hip-hop and alternative hip-hop. And as I said, we'd just write diss raps about each other, about other members of staff on the back of till receipts. And that's what started it all. It just happened. I was the one that kept going and kept writing and wrote more serious stuff. And, yeah.
So, I mean, obviously you were writing stuff about staff at work and stuff, but what was the first thing you wrote and everyone went, shit, mate, this is really good?
Yeah, I know really clearly the first proper thing, because it's a weird one as well, because the reason you mentioned earlier I got in like my space cruiser and toured around the country, the reason for that was I was far more comfortable playing to strangers than playing any of this to any of my friends or family. It felt ridiculous, but there was a song called 1,000 Words, which was exactly 1,000 words long. That's kind of a surreal story of how I got my stammer, of how I almost drowned as a kid and all this kind of thing. And that was the first thing that kind of uploaded it on MySpace or whatever. And I had family members and that kind of reaching out and going, I didn't know you could do this. Like, I remember that happening. I remember this and I remember that. I remember these parts of your life. And that was the first one that kind of, and again, because it was unusual, it's weird. It's bringing the maths and art together, isn't it? I made it exactly 1,000 words long.
Because
I had some kind of unusual twist to it, it was the first one that made me think, oh, maybe I could do this to some level kind of thing as a professional as such.
So you've got an hour of material together and then just set off around the country performing it?
Not even that. that's an exaggeration. I've probably claimed that somewhere just to make myself feel more professional. It's really funny because I was chatting to someone recently and they were asking about, it was a thing about first gigs and stuff. And I didn't realise at all. Again, it's the kind of the ability of throwing yourselves into things, I think. I'd quit my job. I'd saved up enough money to not have a job for a year. And by that, I literally mean like $4,000 or $5,000. I didn't have expensive lifestyle tastes. So it was a few grand. I was going to be living in a van. And I'd save that up and I'd quit my job in HMV. I'd been there for 5-6 years. I was climbing the ladder. I could have thought about it being a career. And I went on the road, as you say. And it's only years and years later I realised at that point I'd never performed any of this in front of anyone.
Blimey.
So I didn't know I could do it. It's luck now that it turns out I could do it. It's kind of that if you've got something to fall back on, you're more likely to fall back.
Yeah.
It was that kind of thing. I didn't have a choice. I had to succeed at it because I'd quit my job.
Yeah, right.
I had nothing else. Like I could reapply my retail experience in another retail job. That's about it. There weren't any other options. So yeah, I had an album's worth, which was probably more about 40, 45 minutes. And yeah, I set about trying to win people over.
And when did that change for you? When did it really sort of drop for you?
Oh, it was a mad one. It was almost a year to the day. Like I'd quit my job saying I'll give myself a year. Because again, I'm realistic as well. My mum reminded me recently, just as I was setting off in the van, she kind of sat me down and said, look, because my parents have both always been really supportive of, look, we just want you to be happy. If working in London will make you happy, go and do that. If working in HMV will make you happy, go and do that. It's not about money or wealth or anything else. And my mum kind of sat me down and said, look, what do you want from this? And I don't remember this at all, but she remembers it so clearly. I said, basically, I want the people that I respect to respect me, like in music. And that was it. And she was like, right, no, that's achievable. She was like, if you want to earn millions or whatever, it might not happen. It's a hard industry or whatever. And she was like, all right, no, that sounds like that's something you might be able to do. So yeah, go at it. So yeah, but it was almost a year to the day that Thou Shalt Always Kill came out and got in the top 40. And it was kind of, at that point, it was like, right, I don't have to go back yet. I've still got mates in HMV that I'm regularly like, you might hear from me this Christmas. I might have to come on and do some Christmas temp stuff. But yeah, so far I've not had to return.
It's something we talk about a lot, you know, like money, because ultimately, especially this industry, without it, it's tough, isn't it? And it's tough to take that leap. I was saying on a previous podcast, I've said it on loads of podcasts about my fear of leaving my other job. And my other job was pretty good. It was teaching. So it was still in an artistic format, but I wasn't doing what I really love to do, which is make people laugh and act and stuff. Yeah. And I really, really have struggled with the idea of letting go of the consistent money coming in, money I know I can pay my bills. But, you know, because I come from a childhood where we lost everything. So that fear is there. I don't need to go to a therapist for that. You're sort of leaping and just like getting in that van with only $3,000. Like I just definitely wouldn't have done that. I wouldn't have gone until I had $10,000 or something. But like, where does that lack of fear for you come? Was it your mum and dad?
I almost interrupted you there because, I think an important part that I often forget to mention in my story is I lived at home with my mum at that point still. You know, I was 25 or whatever, but again, that's because I weren't earning enough to get my own place. But that is a real advantage. That's a benefit. There's a lot of people, if I was having to pay rent or whatever, I wouldn't have been able to take that leap. It just happens that for me at that point, I was living at home with my mum, so it was only my ego that was at risk as such, if you know what I mean. I wouldn't be able to have the nights out. I wouldn't be able to have nice things or whatever else, but I'd never really been into any of that. So yeah, it was that. I knew I kind of had that safety net. And it was also the realisation, at the time I quit was when I was being asked to, I was about to say audition, interview for, or apply for assistant manager jobs. And I was like, right, either... Because again, I've got nothing but respect for retail. So I was like, either I stop claiming I'm going to do music and I focus on retail and do it properly and be really good at it, or I stop here and I go off and try a music, because it felt fake. It felt like I was working in this record store, but I was, you know, I was playing people a track here or there, or I was writing raps all the time and things like that. It's like, I felt like, do I want to do this, or do I want people to think, like, do I want to be a rapper, or do I want people to think I'm a rapper?
Right, yeah.
I've got mates who I wrote raps with on the tours in HMV who were better than me.
Yeah.
I just feel I'm the one that went, no, I'm going to do this, and did it. And that's why it kind of,
I've got mates that are really, really talented, trained with them at drama school, trained with them at, I went to the Brit School College. Yeah. And they were all really fucking talented, but a lot of them dropped off along the way for financial reasons.
Yeah.
I think like a lot of it, 80% of it is stickability. Like, you've got to be good, got to be good to stay there. But 80% of it is like sticking at it. And it's like, it's really hard. You know, and you hear people go, work hard enough, it'll come. Not for everyone, it fucking don't.
It's not
as simple as that.
It really isn't as simple as that. It's why I never kind of, I'm always open about my story, but I've never done one of them posts of kind of quit your job and follow your passion.
Oh no,
because it's not as simple as that. It worked out for me, wicked. But I know how much luck there is in that. There's talent and there's hard work as well, but I know how much luck is a key part of that. So,
of course,
it's kind of I've never been one to be like, here's my story, you can do it too.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Can I ask a question about the first time you performed your first live gig? How did that feel like?
Again, there's another thing of luck and having good mates, I guess. So when I went off on that tour in my van, I had my mate Chris with me, who I knew from, I met in college. And then when I was at uni in Wolverhampton, he was at uni in Birmingham. So I'd go and spend a lot of time there. So we set off in this van, and then the first place I decided I was going to perform was outside a DJ Shadow album launch things. So it was like it was at his label, and you could queue up and they were going to let a certain amount of people in to hear this new record. And I'm there and I'm good to go. And my ass went. I completely bottled it. I was like, oh, I don't know what I'm doing. I've practiced all this at home, but I've never been a big performer. I wasn't a stage school kid. I wasn't any of these things. It's like, what am I doing? But because my mate Chris was there, and he wasn't harsh with it, he was just like, go on then, you're going to do it. And I genuinely feel if I was on my own, I could have given myself an excuse to leave. But because my mate was there, I had to be like, yeah, all right, I'm not, cool, I'll go and do it. Like,
did you have a little sound system and just like a little speaker or whatever?
I had two things on that tour. I had a Ghetto Blaster with me I had my beats on tape. So I'd convert it onto tape so I could do that. And I had a little portable amp that I plugged a mic in, but I put the mic through a loop pedal. So either I could press play on the beats and rap and it'll come out the mic, or I'd beatbox into the loop pedal and build up a thing and then rap over the top of that. Or I'd just do spoken words. So it was kind of, it meant I had options. As I said, we did two different gigs on the same night in London, and then we just went Midlands and further north and further north.
And it's amazing, is it? Because if you were that age now, you could just get on TikTok.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. It's mad. But again, that's something I want to get round to talking about at some point, because moving into acting, I feel far more restricted as a working class person with no particular contacts than with music. I didn't have contacts in music, but MySpace had just appeared. So we could just make songs, upload them to MySpace. Yeah. And that's how all of that happened. Thou Shalt Always Kill blew up on MySpace. And then we sent one burnt CD to John Kennedy at XFM. He played it. And then Rob the Bank played it on Radio 1. And Zane Lowe played it. And Joe Wiley played it. All of this. And that was all stuff where we didn't have to know anyone. Whereas the thing I'm finding more and more with script writing in particular is... Mm-hmm. It's really fucking hard to kick down those doors.
It is.
What made you do it? Why did you suddenly go, do you know what? Like, I'm having this brilliant success as a performer and as a music producer, but I really want to act and write. Like, was there have this something you've always wanted to do, and it was just the moment presented itself?
It was a moment of people letting me realise I was allowed. It's such a weird thing. We've spoken of all these different things that I've just gone and done anyway. Acting was one, again, particularly having a stutter, particularly being working class, all these things that I tried. Before the music, I'd made like some short films and stuff like that. It was always something I was into, but it was Riz Ahmed and Nick Frost and Simon Pegg and a few others who I'd met through my music, who were either fans of the music or I'd gigged with Riz, and Paddy Considine as well. It was after I'd had him on the podcast. It was those four people that I was a huge fan of, that all of them at different points said, so when you're doing acting then? Because it's all I wanted to talk to them about. Like, I wouldn't want to, Dad want to talk about music, and I'd want to talk about either their films or other films. It was always the thing that I was most passionate about. And it was talking to them guys that made me go, like, when me and Dan were doing music, we'd almost every early release, because we needed to get attention and we didn't have budget, we'd do like a little skit videos. So we did a fake X Factor audition, and we did a High Fidelity kind of send up that had Nick Frost and Riz Ahmed in, which it was before Riz was as big as he was, so it's now mad to kind of look back on. But I'd write these little sketches to do, and I'd always wanted to move in that direction. But Riz,
but you're it's no surprise to me, you're a storyteller and you're so in touch with the world and feelings, and it does it like it made total sense to me.
All your music's narrative, isn't it? Like everything you've done is narrative.
Yeah. Or that was the thing that Simon Pegg kind of said, was he was like, you know, when you do that angry song, you know, you're not really angry. You know, that's acting. Like always felt I don't have the.
But we act every day as human beings, don't we?
Exactly. So it was giving me that bit of confidence to not feel completely out of place. And then Riz Ahmed hooked me up with a meeting with his manager, and I kind of said to her, or his agent or manager at the time, and I kind of said to her, look, I want to start at the beginning. I want to just work hard and get auditions and all this kind of thing. I was considering going back to my old name, David Meads. I was like, I don't know if I should do this because I don't want to. I was so scared of jumping any queues or feeling entitled, which again, entitled people don't feel that. They don't have that worry. And she was amazing because she almost patted me on the head and kind of said, that's adorable. But if your previous career can, all it will do is get you an audition. It won't get you the role. You need to do the fucking job to get the role. So don't worry about that. If, as I said, if knowing Riz or Simon will get me an audition, use that. It's stupid to not use that. And that kind of gave me the kind of green light to go, all right, I'll do anything I can to get in a room with people. And then, as I said, over the years, I now think I'm worthy of being in that room.
Yeah. I was watching this interview that you'd done about your stutter and talking about the fact that, because we talk a lot about our accents, like I'm a theatre director and I can assure you very few theatre directors talk like this.
Yeah.
Like it just doesn't happen. If there's a very middle-class world, it's a theatre rehearsal room for sure.
Yeah.
And so you don't hear that a lot. But so we talk to our guests a lot about accents and how they feel about their accents and whether it's ever. And you were speaking really interestingly about saying that you feel like your stutter's part of your accent now. Would you? Is that right?
Yeah, it's something I'm proper excited about artistically now. How weird is it to say
I feel excited
artistically about my stutter? But I've been obsessing over it recently. I did a BBC thing a year or two ago and they didn't tell me, but they used an edit in which I stuttered. And it was one of the most emotional things I've had just watching it, because it meant the world, because I work a lot with the British Stammering Association and we've discussed it. And we don't think there's ever been a character who's had a stammer and it hasn't been this key dramatic part of their character and their background.
Because
it shouldn't have to be. It shouldn't be this big. No. You've overcome it. You had your moment. It's like that is a representation of these things. So that meant the world to me, and I'd never really thought about it. Like almost every character I've been up for hasn't had a stammer, and I've not pitched them having one because I don't think every character should. And I don't want to be the stammer guy. I don't want to be the guy that's doing all the stammering roles. But
yeah, of course,
it now really excites me. Every now and then, I've had two self tapes of this year. I've had about 10 or 15 auditions this year, and two of them I've thought this character might work with a stammer, and it's given me a buzz to do my normal self tape and then say, if you've got time, there's a next bit, I've got a stammer, I think this character will work with, but basically all the rest of the time I'm putting the brakes on, I'm going to take the brakes off and the stammer will come where it comes. And it's a buzz because as actors...
That's amazing. That must feel so freeing.
It really does. But just, I mean, as much as anything, artistically, like personally, I don't care. I'm happy. I enjoy finding characters that don't, like, you know, losing yourself in a character. I don't need them all to be me as such.
No actor wants all their characters to be the same as them. That's exactly not why anyone became an actor, is it?
No.
The buzz of, as actors, as theatre directors, as everything, what we're striving for is truth. And that's... Here it is. A stammer is such unbridled, uncontrollable truth.
It's
a hell of a buzz. Because I remember seeing Tourette's Hero did an amazing performance of a Beckett play.
Wow.
And it was just an emotional roller coaster because it was one that was really quick delivery anyway. But if their Tourette's derailed it, then their Tourette's derailed it and they had to pull it back. And it made this amazing, it made an already exciting piece and play. It took it up a notch. I've got scripts sent through before where the character's got a stammer. And I think part of the reason I've not got it is I've, at the start of the audition, I've kind of said, look, I know you've written a stammer into the script. That's not really how stammers work. I'm not going to do where you've written I'm going to do the scene and I will stammer in places and other places I won't. And it's kind of tough because often when you're writing a character with a stammer, as you're not someone who's got a stammer, you do want it to be more performed and more theatrical. And my stammer, as we will have heard from this conversation, it's not there all the time. We could have had half of this and you wouldn't have realized I've got a stammer, and then it's there. And that's how I think a stammer should be represented and present. And then, you know, it can be brought up if it would be brought up naturally, but I love the idea of of that kind of representation of a stammer allowing a truth in a scene that we're all aspiring to.
I think it's so important what you're saying as well, because I think that, like, a lot of the time people who, and with absolutely, like, brilliant intention, and but people, like, trying to create more visibility of all different kinds of walks of life, basically, all different disabilities and abilities and sexualities and everything. We're trying to show, you know, as much as we can, but not necessarily written by or guided by the people who have lived with that. That's not their lived experience. And it was interesting because I was speaking to a mate of mine the day who's a trans man, and he's an actor, and he was saying that all he wants is to see, he doesn't necessarily need to even play it himself, he just wants to see a trans character in something where the story is not about them being trans. He might even just be a boring dude who works in a supermarket and the story is about how boring he is in the supermarket and that's it. And you go, God, that boring guy works in the supermarket. He just wants to see a character in EastEnders who's just working on a market stall, and the whole story isn't just about being a trans character, because of course whatever it is that we have as part of our identity, it's not the only
exactly. And just quickly, there was something I wanted to make sure we try and talk about in this.
Yeah, go on.
Because I think it's really important. And it goes on to that representation, as we were saying. Because I was thinking, I was talking to Stu Whiffin, who put us in touch, and we were talking about the amount of amazing working class inspirations and success stories there are in your Tom Davis, your People Just Do Nothing lads, your Kathy Burks, all of these people. But it also occurred to me that yes, they should 100% be there as absolute examples and inspirations, because they're inspirations to me every day, every time I look at a script. But we also should be aware that 90% of the time to get there, they've had to have a non-working class person with them in the room, or backing them, or in the background, or giving them the seal of approval. And that means there's still a distance to go in this. Do you know what I mean? It's not, people could say, oh, what are you moaning about? There's loads of really successful working class. It's like, yeah, there fucking isn't. It's brilliant. But the amount of rooms I've been in with working class mates, and then the people in the room who are actually pulling the strings and making it work, are very much not. And again, that's not a dig at anyone who's not working class either. They're fucking allies. No. They're hugely important. They're part of this journey as well. But
yeah, especially the ones opening the doors.
Yeah, exactly. They're absolutely allies. They're absolutely a key part of this. But again, it would be beautiful to, you know, more and more I go on set now, and it's not only a female costume and makeup truck. It's other areas of the production. It's a mix, and that's where things are progressing.
It is an interesting thing.
And yeah, I just wanted to make sure, I wanted to get that in there because I think it's something that's overlooked a lot.
It's such a brilliant point. I think there's two things. Quite often I get asked in interviews, like, do I feel that, like, being a woman has held me back as a theatre director? It's a really weird question to ask me. I don't really know, because I've never been a fella, so I don't know what the difference would. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. But I can have a guess by the way I'm treated still, like, you know, 25 years in, that yes, it probably has. But I would say that actually the way I speak and am perceived has had more effect than, or certainly the combination, the intersectionality between being a female and a working class female in a very middle class world has definitely had a lot of impact.
I definitely think there's been situations where the words I'm not stuttering on have done me more damage than the words I'm stuttering on. When they can hear my accent clearly on a good run of words, it's like, oh, hang on. Like, that's doing me as much damage as anything else. But yeah.
And we had an amazing guest on, and if you don't know her, I think you'd absolutely love her. She's called Debree Stevenson, and she's a grime poet, and really fascinating. And interestingly, she came to poetry and language because she couldn't read or write a word at all until she was about 10.
Yeah.
And she is now a prolific, amazing writer of brilliant, you know, material, both lyrical poetry and grime and all sorts of things. She's an amazing person. But she was saying that one of her favourite things now is, like, getting in the door and then jamming her foot in it and grabbing as many other people through the door with her as she can.
100%.
And it's such a brilliant analogy of, like, what we all need to do, really, as working class people for each other.
Yeah, completely. Yeah, open up the table to everyone.
It's like the emotional equivalent. Do you remember when, back in the day, people used to go to the cinema and open the back door for people who couldn't afford the ticket? You could get your mate tense in that way. It's like hollering out, like the cinema back doors open, go, go, go.
It's weird I just mentioned him, because the way me and Stu Whiffin met was me bunking in the back door of his club night, because me and my mates would do that. One of us had paid to go in. He hated us back then. We're dear friends now, but back then he hated us because one of us had paid to go in and the others had all
come round the back.
Obviously, with all the success you've had and are still having, I know we all come at this from a very different position now, and we're all living a privileged life of sorts. Do you still feel working class? Do you think you'll always feel working class?
I think it's a weird one, isn't it? I think one of the reasons I still live in the same town I've always lived in is because I think it's important to check yourself. I always remember I did a gig at the Hammersmith Apollo, and I was doing spoken word. It was this big night of loads of different people, but The Cure were on, Steve Coogan was on, Stuart Lee was on, Professor Brian Cox. It was all these amazing things. And I did that, and I'd done my bit, and then I sat there watching them all. And then I got the train home, and some girls from Tilbury tried to steal my shoes and set my beard on fire. And put makeup on me.
Well,
and that was important, because it was like, if there's ever a night that's going to make you start thinking, I'm up there with fucking Steve Coogan and Stuart Lee. Within an hour of that, I was back being, you're that fucking tall beardy prick on the train that's clearly a target. Look at this fucking weirdo. We're going to try and set your beard on fire.
They set your beard on fire.
They tried to. I stopped them.
well, yeah, you might. Yeah.
It's a stupid story, but stuff like that, again, I think, it's also why I never moved into London, because I think I could have moved into London and been around amazing artists, which would have been amazing, but it would have made me delusional about where we are in society and in the world. Yeah. And yes, I think we've seen a lot of that with Brexit and loads of other horrible things. Yeah. Living somewhere that has still got a lot of racism problems, a lot of drug problems, all sorts of other things. I mean, again, I don't want to give any illusions. It's not like I'm out down the pub every week. I kind of have always kept myself to myself. But, yeah, I don't know. I think it's been important for keeping grounded, is kind of staying around the same areas.
Yeah.
They've always said me, Kay Tempest and Polar Bear have always, because when we were doing a lot of spoken words, we'd end up having to go to some proper posh places, like posh parts of London, all this kind of thing. And we all realised that we're all far more comfortable somewhere where we feel we're at risk of getting kicked in than we are at risk of getting kicked out.
In
certain parts of North and West London, I'd always feel someone's about to tap me on the shoulder and say, on your way, mate. Whereas in South London, I might be at risk of getting a little dig, but I'm far more relaxed with that.
I know. Oh,
is there any
God.
Chance you could have that made into a T-shirt?
It's a good line, isn't it?
I think that literally sums up. That is so brilliant.
Yeah.
Kicked in
hell, that's brilliant.
Than kicked out.
I came up with that a few years back as the kind of summation of it, because it sums
that
it up in the arts as well. In the arts
how
as well, because it is. In the arts, you're always going to end up in areas where you think, oh, I feel like everyone's sneering at me here. I feel like everyone's laughing at me. And we'd always have it, at those spoken word gigs, we'd always have it that they're all sneering at us until we go and do our stuff. And then they're all kissing our asses. And it's like, nah. When you just heard our accents, you were like, oh, who are these? Or saw us walk in. Who are these people? But now we've got up and proven ourselves. So I don't want your approval.
No,
I didn't have your approval at the start. I don't want to earn it. I don't care if I've earned it.
Yeah.
You can keep it.
I think it's almost like a fun game now. Like over the years, I found it to be a bit of a fun game. So like I know I walk into a rehearsal room and everyone goes like, oh, and I speak and people think, oh my God, like what is that? Like that's the director, really, really. And I know it and I take great pleasure in it. Yeah. And I take like great pleasure in not making them feel all right about it for a little while now. I think let them wait.
Yeah.
And like I think in a couple of days I'll be like, oh, we were wrong about making that assumption. Like we're wrong, and it's quite fun. And I think that's one of the things, like going back to hearing you for the first time, and something that me and Laura talk about a lot, to hear someone as erudite as you are and such a wordsmith and such a lover of poetry and with the vocabulary that you have, and but with your accent, is just so inspiring. And when I, you know, especially at that time, it was even, I mean, we're not talking like 50 years ago, are we? But I think that's even in the last 10 years that's improved. Yeah. And I don't think I'd really heard many people speaking in an accent I recognised, doing the work that I loved and felt passionate about as well until I heard you doing your stuff.
I'll never forget the night round your flat in Norwood and you played me Thou Shall Always Kill, and it fucking blew my tiny little mind, I've got to say. Really did.
Again, it's why me, Kay Tempest and Polar Bear were drawn together, because we were in so many rooms where no one looked like us or sounded like us, and we were like...
Yeah.
This is all silly, isn't it? Like, again, embracing it, loads of amazing people. But
it all happens to you in the acting world as well, Pip. Like, you know, like I gravitate to the working class actors. Yeah. I do. I find them, they find me, and it's glorious. Yeah. It's glorious when you get on a real working class kind of set and you're like, 100%. Yeah, there's more of us. Yay.
Or you touched on Walk Like a Panther at the start. A lot of people didn't see that film, but you go on the IMDb. That is a litany of working class heroes throughout the ages of acting. There's so many, obviously Stevie Graham, but there's so many.
Yeah.
Every day I went on set, I'd be like, oh shit, it's that person from that show. Like all people that I'm like, this is amazing. How am I here? And I love that stuff.
I mean, obviously, we could go on all day. Yes. We've got to let you go. We always finish the show asking our guest if there's anyone, a working class hero, they'd like to celebrate today. Who would that be for you?
I thought about this a lot and it made me feel really blessed, because I could pick either of my parents. I could pick so many members of my family. Stu Whiffen, who we mentioned, he came to mind, and my mate Chris, loads of different people. Uncles on my dad's side. My uncle John's the funniest bloke I've ever met. My uncle Pat was the first label manager of Trojan Records. I've got amazing aunts and uncles everywhere. But I've landed on my uncle Rob, and he's my mum's brother. And he probably doesn't know how inspirational he's been to me over the years, because he's done really well for himself. Like he left school early, he didn't do great at school, and he learnt a trade and he became a plumber, and he's ended up having his own plumbing company, and he's done really well for himself. But it's not the kind of you've done well for yourself that makes him a hero to me. It's that he's a proper bloke still. He's proper normal. He's really lovely and normal and a nice person. You know, it's not that he's like a multi-millionaire, but he's, you know, he's got a place in Portugal and stuff like that, and he's done all right. And I mentioned earlier I mentioned earlier of my failed trip to America. But I always remember on that, it was going bad. I was staying in hostels, and most of the hostels, like, I was the top bunk and there was a couple on the bottom bunk and things like that. It was like rough things. And he heard it was going bad and he rang me and said, when he was younger, he travelled America a bit and it was tough. So he said, I've booked you into this hotel, and he booked me into like a 250 quid a night hotel for a couple of nights, just to kind of say, look, just relax a bit and take a weight off. And it was a lifesaver, because it was such a weird, hard, isolated time, and just having that little bit of luxury. And throughout his life, I always enjoy catching up with him, because we will either be somewhere proper working class or we'll be somewhere proper posh, but he'll be the same bloke regardless. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing.
What does he do for a living?
He's a plumber. He runs a plumbing company.
And what's his full name?
Robert Latham.
So we're celebrating him as well as you today, Pip. Scroobius Pip. It's been honestly... Like, fucking, if you'd have, me and Hannah would have said we're going to be interviewing you in our second series, we'd have told whoever that was to fuck off, because we're just honestly massive fans.
Mate,
and I'm so
to
excited.
Be asked.
Listen, I might even get to work with you one day, you know, if we're lucky.
I'd love to.
If I'm lucky.
I love King Gary. Scrooge blew me away. I'm excited to be here. You guys are great. And as soon as Stu, told me what the podcast was about, I was like, right, that's a new one on my download list anyway. So, yeah.
Oh, honored thank to be you here. So much. That means the world.
Thank you, mate.
Cheers.
Oh, my God, Hannah.
I know, what a brilliant, if you'd have told me, like, you know, back in the day when we were sat around my table up Norwood Junction, that one day he'd be on our podcast, I'd have thought you were having a laugh. I mean, just everything about him. Like, I mean, obviously his work, which, as you know, we've banged on quite a lot in there. He's probably taking out a restraining order as we speak. But
yeah. Began, hopefully we'll work together.
It's like that. It's called his agent saying, don't ever put me up for anything she's up for. But obviously, like, you know, we've always loved his work, and that goes without saying, that stands. Yeah. But I think also just that courage to reinvent yourself, start again, go, I'm at the top of my game in this, but you know what, I'm going to do that. Yeah. And I just find that really an amazing thing. And
quite a good lesson in how to survive this industry and to learn not to box yourself in. Like, if you've got a talent for something, you think you can do it. And also, you know, he's a storyteller. Of course he's a good actor.
Yeah, it's a very British mentality, isn't it, that people only do one thing. And he's got a much more kind of sort of, like, you know, American attitude.
Of course.
I make movies, I write scripts, I make hip-hop, I'm a spoke. You know, it's just it's a brilliant lesson. And he was very early doors for all of that stuff as well. So it's, like, doubly impressive, really.
Yeah.
Absolutely everything I hoped it would be, that conversation. Fantastic.
And you know what? If you're not familiar with Pip's work, please do go and check him out. Acting, his podcast, Distractions, and all of his music. Get on YouTube, because he's a super talented fella and a top bloke. And we're so lucky to have had him. So that's it, folks. That's the penultimate episode of the series. Next week is our final episode of the series. I mean, have we saved the best till last? Well, I don't know. You'll have to tune in to find out, wouldn't you? But until then, like I always say, keep it classy. The Proper Class podcast is produced by Michelle Farr-Scott for Rangabee Productions, edited by James Torrance, with music by Tommy Music. Just to let you know, folks, the Proper Class podcast is now going weekly. And whilst I've got you here, please don't forget to like and subscribe. Spread the word. Tell your friends, neighbours, whoever will listen. We've also got an Instagram page. Ooh, get us. And you can follow all the news and goss at the Proper Class podcast. And if you haven't nodded off yet, we've also gone and got ourselves an official email. So do get in touch. The email is properclasspodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, folks. And remember, keep it classy.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.